Where do you see God today? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Matilde Frey, Professor of Biblical Studies in the School of Theology at Walla Walla University. I'm your host and study guide author, and this week our lesson is all about Jesus, hour of glory, the cross and the resurrection. My conversation partners are Alex Bryan, president at Walla Walla University, and Andreas Bekai, pastor at the University Church. Where do you see God today?
You know, I think about Elie Wiesel, who wrote in his book Night, where he describes a scene from a concentration camp, and I'll read it for you, in Auschwitz. This is what he says, quote, "One day, as we returned from work, we saw three gallows, three black ravens, erected on the Appelplatz. Roll call. The SS surrounding us, machine guns aimed at us, the usual ritual. Three prisoners in chains, and among them the little Papel, the sad-eyed angel. The SS seemed more preoccupied, more worried than usual. To hang a child in front of thousands of onlookers was not a small matter. The head of the camp read the verdict. All eyes were on the child. He was pale, almost calm, but he was biting his lips as he stood on the shadow of the gallows. This time, the Lager Kapo, I'm saying that wrong, refused to act as an executioner. Three SS took his place. The three condemned prisoners together stepped onto the chairs. In unison, the nooses were placed around their necks. Long live liberty, shouted the two men, but the boy was silent. Where is merciful God? Where is he? Someone behind me was asking. At the signal, the three chairs were tipped over. Total silence in the camp. On the horizon, the sun was setting. Caps off, screamed the Lager Testi. His voice quivered. As for the rest of us, we were weeping. Cover your heads. Then came the march past the victims. The two men were no longer alive. Their tongues were hanging out, swollen and bluish. But the third rope was still moving. The child, too light, was still breathing. So he remained for more than half an hour, lingering between life and death, writhing before our eyes. And as we were forced to look at him at close range, he was still alive when I passed him. His tongue was still red, his eyes not yet extinguished. Behind me, I heard the same man asking, for God's sake, where is God? And from within me, I heard a voice answer, where is he? This is where, hanging here from these gallows. Haunting.
It's impossible to read the story and not feel deeply touched, deeply moved. And so in the Gospel of John, chapter 18, we come to a description of the crucifixion narrative that points out some scenes that are deeply moving, but that are also different from the other three Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels. And we could take a few of those or some of these and see how John is actually describing Jesus' crucifixion. For example, the first thing we are able to notice is in John's gospel, there is no one who carries Jesus' cross. Mm. There is no Simon of Cyrene, and so Jesus carries his own burden. Are there other things that you notice that we could mention?
I mean, I think we also notice the brevity of the crucifixion account in John. It just says when the soldiers had crucified Jesus, and then it moves on, really perhaps hinting that the crucifixion itself is not really the primary focus, because there's lots of other details and important things happening around that moment. But that's certainly different to some of the other gospel accounts.
I think this is a broader comment, but throughout both the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament and the New, you have a lot of effective emotional language associated with God. So you see that in a lot of places. But the highest concentration of that is in the Gospel of John. If you just look at the usages of emotional languages attributed to God, is in the Gospel of John. It's the most emotional of all the books. And then you have an intensification of that beginning in John 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Throughout that discourse that you referenced, Matilda, that speech, that final discourse, and it spills over here into the intensity of the description of the crucifixion in John. So I think I'm just struck by how we are often uncomfortable with feelings, with the emotions, and we talk about, you know, we need to don't let your emotions drive you. Well, there's good emotions and bad, right? And I think this is an invitation to the loneliness of Jesus carrying the cross on his own, the loneliness of being a human being, deep suffering, deep feeling, and to the opening story, Andreas, that you read, a deep connection to a suffering God, a suffering Jesus. I mean, I got to be honest. I don't know where I would be without the suffering components of the gospel in terms of my own Christian connection, because that's what actually opens you up into something about God and ourselves that, I mean, where would we be without that? If Jesus had just finished triumphantly without having a scratch on his arm and on it went, I mean, that's very much the political stories and the religious stories of triumphalism that we see everywhere else. I mean, here you have the exact opposite of it. And even in the resurrection narrative that we might touch on maybe next week a little bit, even there you have the scars, right? The scars remain. So I don't know, Matilda and Andreas, for me, this section of John that just leans so thickly into what it means to have human emotion, to suffer, to be alone, and for there not to be an out. There's no out in this, yeah. You know, but then, of course, the resurrection will come and we'll look at that. But even in resurrection, to be bearing those scars, when I say I don't know what I would do without it, I mean, I just the significance of this, you know, we think about its salvific significance or its theological implications. But when you just read it from a pure human level, these last, again, 8 or 9 chapters of the Gospel of John, it welcomes us into a place of realism. You know when a preacher stands up front and you think he just doesn't understand or she just doesn't understand? Mm. These chapters tell me that God understands.
Mm. Yeah, and I think also about a comment that we had made about Philip in one of our previous segments, in which Jesus recognizes that Philip is without any mentioned kin and has no siblings among the disciples. And the word he repeats are words that speak to his lack of abundance. He talks about enough. Is there enough food? And show me the Father, and that will be enough. And Jesus says, no, I am enough, and I'll show you the way to the Father, perhaps helping to deal with the lack that he has in his life and the loneliness that Philip seems to be painted as suffering. And then we see Jesus here having offered sufficiency to Philip and community to Philip. Here, without his mother at the cross, would be completely alone, because we do not know of any other kin that are there with him at the cross, but his mother is there with him. And you also mentioned this real fleshly Jesus that we have here at the cross, and we hear Jesus saying, I'm thirsty, unlike the synoptics, and we hear Jesus, you know, asking for something, a very basic human need, in a way that holds together his humanity and his divinity, that he is hanging on a Roman cross for us, but is also so human that he needs to ask someone else to help him when he is thirsty, the one who has been promising everyone else that he is the water of life and that rivers of water will come through him. Now he needs other people when he is thirsty on the cross. So it's a powerful and haunting picture of Jesus, all the way at the end, perhaps coming full circle to being the life and the light at the beginning, to now his life being extinguished here at the end and needing others that he came to save to help him in his moment of desperate need.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Andreas. That kind of like puts the story with the little boy so vividly before us, isn't it? Mm. So the Jesus on the cross is the human who suffers in a very corporal way, in the human body, in the flesh, the thirstiness of Jesus. In the other Gospels, he is offered the drink. In this one, he asks for it. Mm. And that is what makes the Gospel again stand apart from the others. The resurrection is then the culmination of this act of incarnation. So incarnation is life, death, and resurrection. Now, the readers of the Gospel of John, they were not there. And they basically, we and the readers of the Gospel of John in the second century, we are in the same place. Mm. So we come basically full circle what we talked about early on in our discussions, that the Gospel of John is for us in the same way as it was for them, something that is a story that is brought into the present life. And so is it possible now when Jesus says, blessed are those who have not seen, that that is very much applicable to us as well, not just to Thomas, who asked for something.
I think that's such an important point. There's such relatability to our experience and the experience to the people John was writing to. In fact, we in many ways, we wouldn't think this way because it's been 1900 years, but we have in some ways more in common with the second century than the second century had with the first.
Say more.
Because we don't have it, because we did not see Jesus as eyewitnesses. Mm. And this is, and you see this in Paul's later writings, you definitely see it here in John, and you see it in the writings of some of the early church material in the second century, where they're coming to grips with this place that they find themselves in. And there's in many ways, there's echoes of this in the Adventist movement, where we move further and further away from our origin date, which is now almost 200 years away, where we're struggling with the same pieces, right? The further you get away, you have to deal with new issues of distance. And so, yeah, I think, Matilda, your point is spot on.
Well, we are almost at the end. I just find it so beautiful when Mary, who is going on the first day of the week, and she does not recognize Jesus, but for her, Jesus is the gardener. So I love that in the Gospel of John, every little detail is meaningful, including the part where Jesus is a gardener and not Jesus. The gardener is the one who brings life back from the soil. And again, we have to go back to Genesis chapter 2, where God is the gardener, bringing life out of the dust from the ground. In the Hebrew, this is the Adama, and God creates the Adam, the human, out of the humus we become humans, right? And there is Jesus, the one who is that gardener imagery that Mary is then recognizing first, and then Jesus says, I am. Thank you so much for our conversation together, and I am thankful for Alex Bryan and Andreas Bekai, and also for our program engineer, Corin Bailey, and to all of you who are listening in today. For The Good Word, I'm Matilda Fry.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.